Proverbs 24, verse 6. We finished that up last week. There were a couple of verses I wanted to read to go along with it. Just to go back through it again, it says, "For by wise counsel you will wage your own war, and a multitude of counselors there is safety." We were just talking about, and well, putting verse 5 with it as well, "A wise man is strong." Talking about how wisdom brings strength, and wisdom, especially God's wisdom, much better than physical strength. We gave the example of David and Goliath. Certainly Goliath had the physical strength, but David was victorious because of God's help. And I just want to put three verses with it to kind of get this idea about trusting in the Lord and how that increases our strength. I'm going to read in Ephesians 3:20. If someone will turn to Romans 8 and be ready to read verse 31. Romans 8:31. I'll read Ephesians 3, verse 20. "Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us." If someone will read Romans 8:31.
"What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?"
In Philippians 4, verse 13. "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." I think all those verses point to the same idea being presented here by Solomon in Proverbs, that godly wisdom brings strength. He provides us. It's not our strength. It's not because we're strong, but because he makes us strong and he is great. Any final thoughts on that idea? Just didn't get a chance to cover those last week and wanted to make sure we did.
We don't need that right away. You know, it seems like it takes time for us to go through things, for us to really grasp hold of and believe in those scriptures.
Yeah. You know, and the other thing we can do, we can plaster them on bumper stickers, or we can have them at the bottom of our email, and we can quote them and still not believe them. You know, we don't really do it. We don't really trust him. I mean, we say it and we can quote it, and we'll tell other people, well, you know, Philippians 4:13. But we don't do it when it comes to us. It has to be a reality, and that's certainly something that studying and thinking about these things will help to make it real. Good. Any other thoughts? Okay, let's look at 7. "Wisdom is too lofty for a fool. He does not open his mouth in the gate." It's not that a man cannot understand God's wisdom. We can, right? We go back to Proverbs chapter 1. You could look at... Let's go back there real quickly. Proverbs 1. You remember how at the beginning of the book of Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman calling out, trying to get people's attention so they will listen to her and see the advantages that she brings. Verse 20 of Proverbs 1. "Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief concourses, at the openings of the gates in the city. She speaks her words. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn at my rebuke. Surely I will pour out my spirit on you, and I will make my words known to you." So read that in answer to the question or answer to the statement someone might make. Well, maybe I just can't understand wisdom. What did God just tell us about wisdom? Can you understand it? Who can understand it? And those become wise, but who is it available to? Maybe that's a better way to ask. Anybody who will seek it. And she's basically screaming, just saying, come to me. I am here. I am available for you. But you have to accept it. And then he talks about the fools and the scoffers, those who don't want it. That's the problem here. Wisdom is too lofty for a fool. Not because he's not smart enough to understand it. What is the fool's problem? Yeah, he just doesn't want it. He doesn't want to accept it. So that's what keeps him from being able to, you know... Have you ever studied with someone who said, I just can't understand the Bible? I tried, and I can't understand it. What do you say when you hear that?
I like to ask them where they started trying to understand it. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you start out reading Revelations, begin with, and I can understand a statement like that.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's all relevant. You start at the beginning.
Yeah. if you were taking a class on physics, would you start studying in chapter 20? Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You begin at the beginning, and you set the foundations, and you build upon that. And, I mean, Les is right. We can make it so much harder than it is. Does it take effort?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's where I'm afraid that the problem is for a lot of people. Well, I tried to study the Bible, and it just didn't work out. And for a lot of folks, they may not have tried very hard. They may have just sat down and they flipped to Zephaniah and they started reading something there and like, I don't know what's going on. And so they didn't try anymore. It does take some effort. It certainly takes a good approach. And we'll talk about that a little more in the next hour as well. What about this? He does not open his mouth in the gate. What was important about the gates of a city? Do you remember... Not as far as defense of the city goes, but do you remember some of the things that took place in the gates of cities in ancient times?
Well, that's where the judgments.
Yeah, judgments.
It's where the elders of the city, the men that had wisdom, that's where they would spend their time.
That's right.
They would make judgments on people and give the advice. That's where people came to seek advice.
Yeah, that's where the important decisions were often made. You remember in the book of Ruth, Boaz goes to the elders at the gates of the city to redeem Ruth. So all the big decisions, they were made there at the gates of the city. It's interesting to me when you read in verse 7, wisdom's too lofty for a fool. He does not open his mouth in the gate. Well, important decisions are being made in the gate. We see in Proverbs 31, the woman helps her husband so that he is well known and well respected in the gate. A lot due to her influence. Why can't, when people are speaking of wise things, what does the fool have to say?
Nothing.
He has nothing worthwhile to say when people are speaking wisdom. That's the point. He doesn't have anything to contribute here. He's not willing, to use a New Testament phrase, he's not willing to count the cost of being a disciple. He doesn't know these things, doesn't know what it requires. And so, verse 7 is too lofty for him. It's up here, not because God has made it unobtainable. He's done it to himself. He doesn't want it. He hasn't made the effort to get that. All of these things tie in. Good. Anything else you want to add to 7? Okay, let's look at 8 and 9 together. He who plots to do evil will be called a schemer. The devising of foolishness is sin, and the scoffer is an abomination to men. So this is sort of running just the opposite of what we just saw. The fool has no place in the gates where wisdom is. But the fool may tend to support the efforts of those who scheme and plot and work mischief, which is one of the ironic things. There are those who will claim that the Bible is too difficult to follow, but they will get involved in some of the most complicated schemes and mischief that you can imagine. And why are they able to follow that, but this is too difficult?
It's where their interest is.
It's where their heart lies. That is what they are interested in. That's what they really want. This section here, the scoffers, an abomination to men. Those who scoff at God's ways and do their own thing, they're an abomination. We've talked about that before. What is that? What is an abomination?
Something that God hates.
Yeah, it's disgusting. It is something completely perverse and disgusting to God. Good. Mark your places. Turn to 2 Corinthians 5. There are some brilliant scoffers in this world. They are smart people, as far as worldly knowledge goes, they just incredible in the things they can understand, in the worldly subjects that they can master. No matter how brilliant a scoffer is, what happens to it at judgment? 2 Corinthians 5, if someone will read verse 10 for us.
For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil.
What happens to the one who would scoff at God's word then, when the judgment of Christ takes place?
He'd be judged for his evil deeds.
Yeah, I mean, it is emptiness, it is despair, and all that brilliance and all that promise and potential, it's just lost. And what a waste. What a wasted life when it comes to that point. Look at verse 10. I think this can be taken with the previous two verses, but it kind of struck me in another way. Verse 10, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. When hard times come, if I shy away from doing what's right, why? What's the problem?
Faith is not strong enough.
If it says here your strength is small, but it really, to me, the application is my faith is not strong enough. It's not what it needs to be. It's too small. You know, whose fault is that? It's mine. If my faith is not what it should be, it's my fault. Because He's provided me with everything to make my faith what it should be, my strength what it should be. If it's not there, it's because I'm not doing it. You know, it is so easy to stand at a pulpit or wherever and preach about how we need to stand up against false doctrine. And when adversity and persecution comes, we need to do this and we need to do this. And then it comes. And then just bow down and roll over and say nothing. It's easy to talk about standing up for truth when you don't have to. But when you really have to, that's the question. Will we do it then? I mean, anybody can say it. Will we do it when it really comes? And certainly some of you guys have had to face some bad times where you had to stand up for truth. You lost friends over it. And they still won't talk to you this day because of standing up for truth. Will we do it? Or will we just talk a good game? That's the question. What will my strength really be like when adversity comes? That's the question. And really only time's going to answer that. It, as Les mentioned, it comes down to faith. You know, it's something to talk a good game. It's entirely something else to tell Herod he has no right to his wife. Those are two different things, right? John did it when he had to. He did it because it was right. What will we do? What will I do when the time comes? Any thoughts on that? Adversity. Strength of our faith. Look at 11 and 12. Deliver those who are drawn toward death. Hold back those stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, surely we did not know this, does not he who weighs the hearts consider it? He who keeps your soul, does he not know it? And will he not render to each man according to his deeds? This is certainly true in the physical sense. If there are those who are in danger in a physical way and I have an opportunity to help them, I should do that. There's no question. Let's go to Psalm 82. Psalm 82. I'm just thinking about recognizing physical needs that people have and what my responsibility is. Psalm 82, verse 3. Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Free them from the hand of the wicked. Okay. In a physical sense, if I have the ability and the opportunity to help someone, what should I do? Okay. I think it's very clear. I think maybe the more important aspect of this is the spiritual side. You can help those who are in physical need all day long and yet see people who have a spiritual need and you don't do anything about that. Now, what are some ways we can help others spiritually? How can we make an application from 11 and 12? Deliver those who are drawn toward death. Hold back those who are stumbling toward slaughter. What's the spiritual application for us as Christians?
If you see someone in error heading that way, that we should caution them, warn them, and try to turn them around.
People are on the path to destruction. People are on a path to hell. It's how many people? Most people. Most are. Can we do something about it?
Yes, if they will allow.
we can at least warn, right? We can do that. You can't make the decision for them. You can't grab them and pull them off that path and drag them to the right way. But you can at least warn them. Yeah, think of Ezekiel and the watchman. What was the watchman's responsibility? Yeah, blow the horn. Yeah, blow the horn. And then whose hands is it in? In the hands of the people then, right? If you blow the horn and you warn them and they just keep on sleeping, then their blood's on their own hands. But you have to sound the trumpet. That's our responsibility. Warn them and tell them. And notice verse 12. And don't act like you didn't see it. That's, you know, the song that we lead it every now and then. You never mention him to me. I love that song and hate it all at the same time. I love it because it's so true and so right. And I hate it because it makes me feel like dirt every time somebody leads it, because I feel so guilty. And I need to feel guilty, because if I'm guilty, it means I haven't been doing something like I should. That song makes me think about all the missed opportunities. And I really think you can apply verse 12 with it. Surely we did not know this. Oh, you didn't know those people were lost, huh? You saw them and you worked with them every single day for 15 years and you had no idea? You knew. What did you say? What did you do about it? I think, and I guess in the story it's a physical example, but I believe there are spiritual applications. You remember, we often call it the story of the Good Samaritan, but I'm thinking of the Levite and the priest in that story. They saw a need there. And what do?
Just keep walking.
We may look and see how bad it is, but then we keep walking. And the spiritual application, I think, is exactly what 12 is talking about. Here's a need. Here are souls being lost. And you don't even try. What are we doing? It's just certainly this verse is definitely aimed at me, and I need to be much better at this. Anything else you guys want to bring out in 11 or 12? Put 13 and 14 together. My son, eat honey because it is good, and the honeycomb which is sweet to your taste. So shall the knowledge of wisdom be to your soul. If you have found it, there is a prospect, and your hope will not be cut off. You got the comparison there. Honey is good, it is sweet, and wisdom is like honey for your soul. It is good, it is sweet, it is that thing that is fulfilling, and you cherish it, you enjoy it. Wisdom instructs us as to our purpose in life. We talked about it a little bit last week. What is our purpose in life? I think Ecclesiastes tells us, fear God, keep His commandments. And how will I know how to do that? How will I know how to keep His commandments? From His wisdom, right? I mean, all of these go together. It's an idea that repeats itself throughout the wisdom literature, certainly throughout Proverbs. But if I learn it and see what He wants, then I know how to do it. And certainly it still comes down to the heart. I have to do it myself. But He made us to honor Him. That's what we were made for. Are we doing that? And are we taking that seriously? What happens when we don't do that?
We have to answer for it.
We will have to answer for it. And something's missing. Right? He made us to serve Him. When we don't, and we can fill our lives full of worldly things, and we will have happiness in a lot of senses, there will always be something missing until I serve Him like I'm supposed to. I always will. And you look at those who are just incredibly popular, and people want to be just like them, and then you see them going into drug rehab, and you think, how in the world? What did you need from those drugs that you couldn't get from? Well, they're missing something, but they're filling it with the wrong thing. They have the fame, and they have the fortune. They are not serving God, which is what they were made to do. And they will never be completely content and at peace until they do. I won't either. So wisdom helps us to fill that hole. It shows us the need for it, and it shows us how to fill it. Look at 15 and 16. Do not lie in wait, O wicked man, against the dwelling of the righteous. Do not plunder his resting place. For a righteous man may fall seven times and rise again, but the wicked shall fall by calamity. This is a warning from God to the unrighteous. If you would plot to do evil to a righteous man, beware. God sees it. He will repay it. And trouble will come to you because of it. Does trouble come to a righteous man? I guess we need to address that. Here he falls seven times. I mean, that's a lot. But what happens? Now, how in the world can he get up after falling seven times?
Because of his righteousness.
The Lord is his strength. The Lord is the one that gives him the ability and the motivation to get up and continue on. Let's put some with it. We'll go to Hebrews 13. This is another passage. It reminds me of what Norris mentioned earlier. Hebrews 13. If someone will read verses 5 and 6 for us, please.
Keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?
Can you say that? I mean, I know we can quote it and we can read it, but can I say it with all confidence? Because that's what Unless's version actually says. So we may confidently say, the New King James says, so we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? And what is the answer to that question for the righteous? What can man
do?
No. No. Can he hurt me?
Yeah.
Can he kill me?
Yeah.
Then what? Oh, gotcha. He can hurt us. He can kill us. Then what are you going to do? Nothing, because you can't touch him then. You can't touch the righteous after that. And that is the promise. And that is something that the wicked never has. What happens to the wicked? What can happen to him?
He just falls deeper and deeper into wickedness.
This life is miserable, and it just keeps getting wrapped up and wrapped up, and death doesn't bring any relief whatsoever. Because then eternity is torment. It's don't follow this path. There's the warning. I also want to put an Old Testament scripture with it. Psalm 37. And this sounds very much akin to what we read in the verses there in Proverbs. Psalm 37, verse 23. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delights in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. It's just some things to talk about there. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. Does that mean that the Lord takes away the free will of the righteous? So how does he order his steps? If it's not that, how are the good man's steps ordered?
They're in order.
Okay.
The Lord sets the priorities for you.
Yeah. He's given him the pattern, the path to walk. And the good man walks it because he loves the Lord. And he wants to do those things that please the Lord. And it says here at the end of verse 23, and he, the Lord, it's capital He in the New King James, he delights in his way. And it makes God happy when a good man does this. Though he falls, we talked about it before, we'll talk about it again. He will fall. Hard times will come. And struggles will come. But when he falls, he won't stay down. The Lord will lift him up and continue him on his way. So very, very similar to what we read about in the verse there in Proverbs. The wicked, and this whole thing, you have to kind of assume that the wicked is thinking he's going to get some kind of benefit by coming against the house of the righteous. How'd that work out for Haman? In the book of Esther. Well, isn't that really the same thing? Haman came against a righteous man, Mordecai. He sought to undo him and you know, seek what he perceived to be his rightful vengeance against Mordecai. What ends up happening to Haman?
He
He built those gallows to hang Mordecai, and he ends up hanging from them. So that's, I think, one of those examples we can put with the principle that's being presented here. Take this from the perspective of the righteous and go back up to verse 10. For those of us who are Christians, do not quit. Do not quit. This is one of those things, and again, it stands out as an accusation against myself. When discouragement comes, what's the problem? If I'll be honest, when discouragement comes,
I better trust in the Lord.
My faith's not what it should be. It's not. And for those of us who are easily discouraged, what does that say about the level of our faith?
It needs some work.
It does. And this is for me. This is a lesson I need to learn. When we find ourselves getting discouraged on a regular basis, or getting heavily discouraged, where our faith is not what it needs to be. I need to work on that. Because those who truly trust in the Lord and who truly say, "What can man do to me? I trust in the Lord," will not be easily discouraged at every single turn. I know there are weak moments. I understand that. And we pick ourselves up and we go through them. But if I find myself all the time, every little weight that comes along, and I'm just completely born under it, something's wrong with my faith. That is not the kind of behavior of a victorious people. I need to work on it. My strength is not what it should be. My strength is small, according to verse 10. Good. Anything else you guys want to bring out on anything so far through verse 16?
I think it's probably good for us that we do come into those conditions where you're discouraged. And I know that early on we begin to obey the gospel, when we first obeyed the gospel, that we felt like everything is going to be great. Nothing ever going to go wrong with him. But we were coming out of Baptist church, but thank God where he went wrong. But we felt like nothing's ever going to go wrong with him. Now we got it made. About 2 months after that, things started falling apart. You know, our best friends started, dropping out of the church and doing all kinds of crazy things. And we grew from that. I mean, we wanted to quit.
Yeah.
But decided we would hang in there. And we really grew up when those things started happening in the Lord's church that we thought would never happen.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's good that those things happen and you grow from them. You don't quit. You want to quit, but you keep on growing. And then when it happens, it's not quite as bad anymore. You're used to it happening. So you take it a little better.
Yeah. Unless, going off of what Roy mentioned, let's talk about, let's not just make the statement, we need to get stronger. Let's answer the question, how do we do that? What are some ways that we do that? One of the points that, from Roy, don't put rose-colored glasses on and just think that everything is going to be easy. Satan will not let everything be easy. Go to the book of Acts. Were there any problems among Christians in the book of Acts? These are God's people. Ananias and Sapphira? You're going to lie to the apostles? What kind of crazy idea is that? These guys can perform miracles. The Holy Spirit is guiding them. They can see your heart. Let's just lie to them. They're Christians, right? I think we sometimes forget that when we're reading. We see Ananias and Sapphira. These are people washed in the blood of Jesus Christ. At one point, they were completely righteous and holy in His sight. And then they departed from that. That happened in the church with apostles right there. Can it happen today? I am crazy if I think it can't. So don't think just because I see a Christian doing something wrong that it means that the church has failed or that Jesus has failed. Why do we come to worship services?
One deserves our worship.
What, Matt?
God deserves our worship.
Because He is worthy. I love my brethren. I do. And I know they love me. We don't worship each other. And I'm afraid sometimes that people will use it as an excuse. Well, I tell you the reason I didn't go. I stopped going. There are a bunch of hypocrites down there. Well, there may be. Did you go there to worship them? Is that your purpose? I thought we were there to worship the Lord. Did He fail you in any way? Is He less worthy in any way? Then what does it matter? I still have a responsibility to Him no matter what anybody else is doing. Good. So there's one thing. Don't be fooled in this false sense of everything is cotton candy. I mean, there are problems. There will be problems among the faithful. David, man after God's own heart, he had problems? Sure he did. And so what are some other things? Go ahead, Les.
You know, one of the churches there in Revelation, there was all kind of problem there, but yet he said, a few of you,
yeah.
I still, even though there was problems in that congregation, there were still a few that were doing what was right.
Yeah, they were still clothed in white.
God recognizes that.
Yeah.
They didn't quit going just because there was a bunch of them still worshiped the Nicolaitans or whatever was going on there. They kept coming and trying to straighten things out.
Yeah. Could, and that's one thing. If I say to myself, I'm going to stop going because there are hypocrites there, what did I just do? For myself, what did I do? I'm not worshiping.
Condemn yourself to eternity with
them. Yeah, you know, I'm putting myself in the same situation as them. On the other side, what have I done? What am I not doing for them? That's a better way to ask it. That I could have been doing for them. I'm not a good example for them. I mean, if I am so upset about their hypocrisy, sounds like they need to see a good example and some good teaching. I can't do it if I'm at my house and they're here. You know, that example or that excuse rather of, well, I just don't want to get. It is simply an excuse that comes up. What are some other things we can do to make our faith stronger? That's one. Be a realist. I don't know. Maybe that's not the best way to say it. And, you know, some people are optimists. And I think for Christians, we need to be realists. We do need to be optimistic in the sense that we have the hope of heaven and that people can change. But don't be, like, so optimistic that you just don't see what's right in front of you. This is a real problem and it needs to be dealt with. We need to be realists. Don't be a pessimist, though, because when that happens, what does that do to a local congregation? That just sucks the life out of it. I mean, if everybody's pessimistic, then well, there's no work being done for the Lord there. Good. Norse.
You know, I was kind of
glad
for a good word, stay focused, because, you know, if you let your mind wandering and what you see, you know, the type of thing that would draw us away from the church. You know, we looking at, you know, things that we're not focused on. And sometimes that's a good trick to say, you know, we, especially if we're a new convert or old convert, we come out of the world, we see things in the world, and we think that people we worship with is perfect. And that's one of the biggest mistakes that we can make, because He's always put something in our mind, making us think one thing, but if we keep our focus on serving God and what Christ died on the cross for us and all those spiritual things, you know, we if we keep those things, we'll do pretty good.
Yeah.
But if we get sidetracked and start focusing on the word of things, it'll give us everything.
Yeah. Good. What else? What are some other things we can do to make sure our strength stays as it should, our faith?
Surround yourself with strong people.
Yeah. That is so important. What do strong people lead you to do?
Right thing.
They're good examples. Well, there's one thing. They have knowledge. Strong people have knowledge. They have the wisdom. So if I run into trouble and I need counsel, as we're told to seek here, seek wise counsel, they're the ones I can go to. I'd see how they're behaving and how they handle things. I just see how mature Christians act. It'll help me to grow faster. What else?
Read Scripture.
Yeah. It is so important. And it's so easy to miss. We're going to talk about this, Lord willing, in the lesson the next hour as well, too. I have all things that pertain to life and godliness right here. All things. So if I need to know anything that pertains to life and godliness, this is where I go. it does me no good if I don't read it. It does me absolutely no good, brings me no benefit if I don't take advantage of this great thing, this great book that's been given to me. Good, and we will talk about some more in the lesson. Good. Anything else?
Prayer.
Yeah. When my faith is weak, one of the chief indicators is my prayer life is not what it should be. Every single time. I think of the times where, as a Christian, I have been at my weakest, my prayer life has been at its worst. Every single time. You think there's a connection? Then why would that be a connection? We read earlier, he's the source of Christian strength. What if you're not talking to the source? What if you're not plugged into the source or connected to the source? There's no strength coming. And so it just makes sense that we're going to grow weaker and weaker when that happens. All of these are good. We put them together. We can grow as we need to. Good. Anything else you want to point out? Let's look at one more. 17 and 18. One more section. We'll look at two verses. 17 and 18. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him. So what should my attitude be toward my enemy?
Be sad when it happens. I mean, where he says don't rejoice, so you just do the opposite.
What should I want for my enemy?
Salvation. Good for him. You should want him to change his ways. Yeah. If he's doing things that are wrong, that's why he's your enemy, because he's doing things against you that are wrong. And we should want him to change his ways and change his heart. This is hard. I mean, this is really hard. This goes against human nature. It's real easy to say, well, they got what's coming to them.
Yeah, it is. And I should want him to go to heaven. And you think about one of the just those early and principal teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. There's a whole section devoted to this kind of attitude. You know, Matthew 5, 43 through 48. And what will God do regarding justice?
He turn on you and they'll rejoice in it all.
Yeah. He will take care of justice, by the way. I mean, he knows what's right. He knows what's wrong. And he will punish justice. It may not come in the time that I like, but he'll take care of it. And it seems like we can get into the position of saying, well, God, you're not, I don't know what your problem is, because I think, you know, and that may be where a lot of the issue lies right there. But well, let's just go. Matthew 5. Let's go there. We'll stop with this section. But let's do read this. I spent 15 minutes trying to paraphrase what the master said, or we can just read it and get it right. Matthew 5, verse 43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, so what does that mean?
Pardon.
That is the ultimate authority. There's no more question. There's no more consideration. There's no vote. You're not waiting for Congress to come together and make a decision. It is done. It is decided. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Oh, man. Pray for those who cheat me and persecute me and badmouth me and spit in my face? Is that what he's saying? Yes, it is. That's exactly what he's saying. Why? The next verse answers it, right? Why in the world would you do that you may be sons of your Father in heaven? That's exactly what he did. And certainly through the example of his son, literally his son was spit on and beaten and persecuted and mocked and just everything else And what did he do?
Forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. That's the example. That's the perfect example. Les is right. That is not the knee-jerk reaction. This is hard. But what does he call us to be? Be ye holy, for I am holy. He expects us to do the hard things. Can we do it? Can. We have to make the commitment to do it. All right, let's stop there. We'll pick up, we'll finish those thoughts, Lord willing, next Sunday.